time to time, you may have noticed, I will make reference to a piece of writing. What I will say is part of my personal scripture. It could be anything from a book to a sentence. It's something I've come across that speaks to me in some meaningful way and becomes part of my guidepost for living. So my scripture for this morning is by a now retired Unitarian Universalist minister and Reverend Greta Crosby, a piece she wrote a number of years ago, which I find myself coming back to from time to time. Reverend Crosby. Sometimes when the bottom falls out of our life, we are set free. We attain enlightenment, or an enlightenment of sorts. Some perspective, some clarity, some sense of reality, some sense of dealing with things as they are because something profound has happened. When that profound thing happens, we can expect to go through a process. Sometimes a long process, a painful or at least uncomfortable process, in which we let go of something and slowly learn to live again. This is true, no matter what we lose. A loved one, a work, a vision, a hope, an image of ourselves, a part of ourselves. Loss makes artists of us all as we weave new patterns into the fabric of our lives. Reverend Crosby. Sometimes a picture is worth not just 1,000 words. It can evoke feelings and sentiments that go well beyond any number of words. Nearly 3 weeks ago, one such picture appeared on the front pages of a number of newspapers around our country after the series, and it was accompanied by stories about those series of storms and tornadoes that swept across the South earlier this month. The one I had here ran right on the front page, right under the headline on the banner of the New York Times. As I said, it's only one of a number of papers in which the picture appeared. It shows a man, he looks like he's probably about my age, maybe a little older, standing in the rubble of what had been a house with a completely wasted landscape out behind him in the background. His head is down, he's slightly bent over. The rubble he's standing in was the house where his daughter and her family had lived before they were killed by the tornado. According to the story, they were the only close family. This gentleman, whose name is James Devaney had. Well, I look at a picture like this, I've got no way of knowing what was in Mr. Devaney's mind in this scene, or if he was even able at the moment shown here to have any kind of thoughts at all. I don't know what, if any, kind of faith or religious or spiritual grounding he might have, whether it was any help to him or not in this moment. I'm reasonably sure, though, in the moment this picture captures, that Mr. Devaney doesn't have the distance he yet needs to appreciate those words of Reverend Crosby's that I read a little earlier about how loss of a loved one, a hope, a vision, a part of ourselves makes artists of us all as we weave new patterns into the fabric of our lives. My best guess is he's not thinking about new patterns in the fabric of his life right now. He's probably feeling a combination of bewilderment, of emptiness, maybe some sense of anger, probably some outrage, undefined outrage at some sort of a cosmic injustice that's been done him. Maybe at some point further down the road, he'll be able, in Greta's words once again, to weave those new patterns into the fabric of his life. That is my hope for this person who's a complete stranger to me, and yet one whose horrible plight touched the hearts of hundreds of thousands of people who viewed this same image in their morning papers on the seventh day of this month. I counted among the blessings at this point in my life, really, that I had been spared any kind of such devastating, such soul-emptying losses like the one that was portrayed in this picture. But I also have to add that such a blessing as I do recognize has still not made me immune to feelings of anger and to some vaguely undefined sense of feeling that some sort of a cosmic injustice has been done when a loss has come my way. I remember, even though it was almost 30 years ago, I experienced such feelings when my father passed away. He was only 69 years old, only 6 years older than I am now. He and my mother, who is still living, had struggled hard over much of their adult lives just to raise 4 children and to keep themselves financially above water, just barely financially at times. And my father was finally able to retire with some measure of financial security. My sisters and I were all out of the house and on with our own lives. They weren't having to take care of us anymore. The house itself was even paid for. It was finally time for my mother and my father to get back a little something for themselves after all they had given and sacrificed for so many years. But it didn't quite happen that way. Instead, my father died quite suddenly from a very rare form of brain cancer. His death came just a few months after it was first discovered and diagnosed. My Eddington grandfather, on the other hand, that's my father's father, he lived until he was 90 years old. He did his gardening on a little farm in Ohio. He lived to see his grandchildren grow to adulthood. He died quietly in a room that he had built with his own hands. So while my father's death really didn't affect the day-to-day doings of my life pretty much went on the way it would have gone, but it did bring up, as I say, certain feelings of anger and pain in me, as I say, in some kind of a sense, that some sort of an injustice had happened. Why him? Why didn't he get the ears that his father did? Why didn't he get to tend his gardens and see his grandchildren grow up? And to add fuel to my personal fire, all of this took place, coincidentally really, about the same time that the tectonic plates of my own religious thinking and my own faith were undergoing a shift. My father was a devoutly religious man. Read his Bible almost every day, prayed nearly every evening, rarely missed going to church on Sunday, I mean twice on Sunday, the morning and evening services, and that's not to mention the Wednesday night prayer meetings. And this is where I got it. With all of that roiling around in my mind, I even managed to work up a good chunk of anger at a God that I'd actually stopped believing in. Even before any of this had even happened. Well, questions asked out of grief and out of anger and a bottomed-out kind of pain are really just that. They're expressions of grief and anger and pain. They're not really questions at all. And there's a part of us that knows that quite well. There's a part of us that does know that these are not questions for which there is some rational answer. And once I got some reflective distance on my father's death, which in time does come, I was able instead to ask of myself the more pointed and realistic questions, which is, why am I demanding that life be fair and just and always work out and never knock me down? Nobody handed me such a guarantee on the day I was born, after all. And when I eventually get, as I usually do, and I eventually get to where I can ask these kinds of questions of myself when I'm in a situation like this, I end up going back to another one of my pieces of personal scripture, which in this case also happens to be a part of the traditional Judaic and Christian scriptures, namely the book of Job. Now, you don't have to be all that biblically literate to know about Job, largely because the theme of this folktale is such a universal one when it comes to the problem of suffering and why bad things happen to people. The playwright Archibald MacLeish even got a long-running Broadway play, J.D., out of this book, which kind of led me to wonder, as a side question, if the Bible is the will of God, story found in the writings of some of the other ancient Near Eastern religions. It's not unique to Judaic Christian scriptures. As I said, it's a universal story. And in the Hebraic or the Christian New Testament version, you have God and Satan, or the adversary, as the best translation puts it. They make a wager about whether a good and righteous and prosperous man like Job could be pushed to the point where he'll turn on God. Now, poor old Job, of course, has no way of knowing. He's become a kind of poker chip in a cosmic bet. So God tells Satan to hit Job with his best shot, which Satan does with relish. Job loses everything. His daughters and sons are killed by bad guys. His crops fail. A bunch more bad guys kill off his cattle. He gets these horrible boils all over his body. And if that's not enough, he's got these three alleged friends who come to visit him, and each one of them gives him these big, long discourses as to why he is having to endure all that he's enduring, as if he needed that on top of everything else. His wife somehow is allowed to live. She's spared all this. And she comes in with a little more succinct advice for him than these long-winded friends of his. She just says, curse God and die. And that's just the Cliff Notes version, by the way. It's a very long, intricate story, actually. Well, the patience of Job, as one might expect, finally runs out. He just loses it. And he basically does, in time, end up taking his wife's advice about cursing God, even though he doesn't die. He rails at God of all the injustice and unfairness that has befallen him. And God answers Job through a whirlwind, which seemed to be sort of the main mode of communication of the Almighty in those days. Whenever God had something to say, it came through a whirlwind. And he comes back at him through this whirlwind with a pretty cryptic question. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe? All right, remember, I said it was right about the time of my father's death that I was coincidentally doing some serious reworking of my own religious and spiritual and theological ways of thinking and believing. Part of that reworking involved casting overboard anything that no longer made any sense to me, including much of what I had learned from the Bible, and that clearly included this whole Job story. I figured whether you read it on a literal or a metaphorical level, it was still a very cruel and heartless and foolish God being portrayed here. I mean, here's poor Job crying out of his terrible and completely undeserved plight. All he gets from God, in effect, is, look, I'm in charge here, so shut up and deal with it. God is not feeling his pain here. A far cry indeed from the God of love and mercy and kindness that Jesus talked about. So I figured Job's wife was really the truth teller in this whole story, even if nobody else read it that way, and I kind of let it go. But for some reason, that maybe I'm still working on in some ways, something kept bringing me back to the very line that I found so apparent. To the point that I had to ask myself, am I missing something in that question from a seemingly heartless God about where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe? And as the line kept coming back to nag me from time to time, I did discover that once I got rid of all the mythological stuff about God and Satan's little betting game and looked at the whole story and the whole passage instead through the more humanistic set of lenses that